640 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Clean Origin.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Israel has issued new evacuation orders for Palestinian civilians in Rafah ahead of a possible military operation. This Palestinian man, speaking through an interpreter, is heeding the call.
There's no choice. We have to go to the coast like everyone else.
The BBC's Paul Adams picks up the story from there.
7 months of war have totally upended life in the Gaza Strip, displacing most of the population, creating vast new refugee camps. With ceasefire talks still deadlocked, this desperate movement looks set to continue.
Meanwhile, families of hostages held by Hamas are urging Israel not to move in on Rafah, saying it could endanger the lives of their loved ones. Russian attacks in northeast Ukraine have prompted the evacuation of almost 1,800 people from the Kharkiv area. Heavy fighting has continued in the border area following Russia's surprise incursions yesterday. Russia says it has seized five villages near the border. Kharkiv's regional head disputes that, saying not a single meter has been lost. Israeli singer Eden Golan has qualified for the Eurovision Song Contest finals taking place in Sweden, but there are protests against her participation. This Eurovision fan disagrees.
Eurovision is a great thing, and it's supposed to not get the politics involved. It's all about the song.
Health officials are monitoring a bird flu outbreak that has spread to dairy farms in several states. Infectious disease expert Dr. William Schaffner says there's no need to worry.
Pasteurization will kill this virus. Milk, cheese, yogurt, all those good dairy products continue to be safe.
But what if humans are infected?
We've created vaccines already. They're blueprints that are ready to go in the event this virus suddenly develops the capacity to spread among humans.
The Biden administration pledges to spend nearly $200 million to control the spread of bird flu among dairy cows. The sky is putting on quite a light show thanks to an unusually strong solar storm hitting the Earth. Space.com columnist Joe Rayo says, turn your eyes to the skies.
Beautiful colors of light, red and yellow and blue and green. This is the display that could very well be visible.
These northern lights are beautiful, but can potentially disrupt power and communications this weekend. Federal officials have issued a rare geomagnetic storm warning, alerting operators of power plants and spacecraft in orbit to take precautions. Happy birthday to Viola Ford Fletcher, the oldest living survivor of the 1921 Tulsa massacre, has turned 110. Black Wall Street was torched during that massacre in racially motivated violence. This is CBS News.
Don't pay retail for diamonds. Come to cleanorigin.com, the lab-grown diamond experts. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. CleanORIGIN.com. Online or one of our retail stores.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Environmentalists are fighting the Department of Natural Resources over a large central Wisconsin factory farm. As Mike Moen reports, the case shows how concerned communities are.
The group Midwest Environmental Advocates is representing Portage County residents in a lawsuit that claims the DNR reached an illegal settlement with a large livestock facility for a wastewater permit. At issue is whether the state should have allowed public input. MEA staff attorney Adam Boskell says as concentrated animal feeding operations gain a bigger footprint, data is becoming clear about the harm to local resources.
We're seeing concerns over capos in western Wisconsin, too, where there have been significant spills and fish kills.
Boskell points to 2018 county data showing elevated nitrate levels in private wells, saying it rises above the traditional not-in-my-backyard opposition. The DNR couldn't comment on the lawsuit, but some farm groups say large ag facilities have to adhere to strict regulations as they help feed the world. Boskell says people who live near these sites aren't regulators. They're individuals asking for responses to what they feel is a growing crisis.
I really think that we need to stop just accepting that CAFOs can externalize the costs of environmental contamination onto the communities that live downstream or downwind.
Wisconsin currently has nearly 340 CAFOs as consolidation in agriculture outmuscles smaller independent farms. Even though the DNR is targeted in the new lawsuit, the agency was being defended by the state in a separate case for maintaining the permit process for these projects. That suit was brought by industry groups who say they're being overregulated. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny with a high near 65, an afternoon shower possible. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 46. For Sunday, mostly sunny, a high around 78. It will be breezy. Scattered storms Sunday night, a low of 56. More storms Monday, 67.
It's 51 at our studios.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday marks the annual day without childcare. We'll ask again why some politicians would rather make more women quit work and stay home.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Law Review, and my name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this, our second hour on our weekend broadcast. As we do this weekend, every weekend, our deliberation, our consideration, analysis, and review of recent stories, news stories of our times in the areas of justice and law and government, no exception. This weekend in our broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, we spent virtually all of our first hour this weekend talking about the conduct of the trial, this historic trial in the history of our nation going ahead right now in a state courtroom presided over by Justice Juan Merchan, alleging against Donald Trump in 34 different counts some violations of New York finance reporting and failures to properly and accurately describe financial transactions that he and Michael Cohen and others engaged in to prevent information being provided to the larger public about affairs that he has had in the past, or at least sexual events that he's had in the past with women. All of that goes to the overall theme being presented by the prosecution in that case, that while this is a financial case, it is a documents case, it's a reporting case, it is also about election interference. That case, again, proceeding on Monday with the presentation of who is arguably the key witness here, Michael Cohen, who ties together all of this information that has been the subject of testimony and documents and recording, some of it fairly dry, but very important to the presentation of the case. All of that being brought together by Michael Cohen this coming week. Certainly the attorneys for the prosecution meeting with Michael Cohen and working with him, not to rehearse him. Attorneys should not be rehearsing, not providing the witnesses with specific answers, but giving them a sense of the kinds of things that are going to be the subjects of direct examination and then also of cross-examination. Nothing wrong with that in terms of trial preparation. One of the other things, as we have discussed, is the fact that this witness, not unlike some of the others, but at a much higher degree, has an awful lot of baggage out there with respect to his own prior criminal conviction, his own lying, the instances before Congress and in front of other law enforcement authorities, the fact that he himself has been a fixer in many ways for many years for Donald Trump, and right now has this profound animus toward Donald Trump, all of which can be the focus of cross-examination. The attorneys for the prosecution, almost certainly this very weekend, as this broadcast is out here on Civic Media, certainly talking with Michael Cohen, preparing him for, again, not telling him how to answer, but providing him with some thoughts and suggestions about the ways in which he both admits and acknowledges his own baggage, the things that he brings to that witness stand, but also does it in a way that is believable. Again, in our conversation about the credibility of witnesses, the reason why witnesses are believable, as we've talked about Hope Hicks and Stormy Daniels, the various things that the other witnesses, many of whom are employees of the Trump Corporation, how they bring credibility to their story. David Pecker, his presentation at the start of this trial, other witnesses during the course of the trial itself that are together a part of this larger story being presented. that's the challenge that the prosecution has on Monday, to prompt the jury, not necessarily to like, you don't have to like Michael Cohen, but to believe him, even in the midst of all of the other things that may prompt you not to believe him. That is the argument they will certainly make in closing argument as well, about the reason why Michael Cohen, like the other witnesses, should be believed, why he too is a credible witness. All of that, again, going on as the judge says late this past week that perhaps we're moving along at a speed that is more advanced than what we initially thought. Maybe this trial will not, in fact, take 6 to 8 weeks. And indeed, the prosecution has indicated that probably after this week of trial testimony, presumably including Michael Cohen, and my sense is maybe some other document or transactional witnesses to bring the matter to a conclusion, they've indicated they may be done as soon as the 21st of May, in which case then the defense has an opportunity, if they choose to do so, to present their own case. Again, no obligation whatsoever in our criminal justice system for the defendant to provide any information, to provide any testimony, any witnesses, documents, nothing at all. And it will certainly be a source of great focus by all of us, including the media, including court watchers, to understand what happens here after the prosecution rests, presumably sometime in about a week, maybe a little bit more than a week from right now. Those other trials, again, unlikely to go in 2024, maybe in 2025. The Mar-a-Lago case, just because Eileen Cannon has now taken that trial date off of her docket as of just this past week. The Georgia case involving election interference, that matter now before the Court of Appeals on the issue of who is going to be responsible for trying that case, an appeal of Scott McAfee's order. Even if he continues to preside over the litigation of that matter, highly likely that that case will not go to trial. And of course, we also have pending before the Supreme Court these two major cases involving whether or not a particular statute under which a fellow named Fisher has been prosecuted for his involvement in the January 6th assault, whether that is the proper statute. The reason why that is so important is because that's also the statute under which Donald Trump has been prosecuted in the separate and discrete case against him pending in front of Tanya Chutkan. The oral argument in that case of a number of weeks ago indicates that the Supreme Court may well have some problems with the manner in which the government, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, has used that statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 1512, to charge Mr. Fisher and hundreds of other people. And they, in fact, may define that statute in a way that prompts the prosecution, the Department of Justice, to have to go back and either recharge or retry, represent these cases, perhaps even to a grand jury, depending upon what the court rules in Fisher. And again, that could also have an implication when it comes to the processing of the case against Donald Trump before Judge Eileen Cannon. The other major case also pending in front of the Supreme Court, as we have talked about a lot on this broadcast, is that major immunity case. Donald Trump maintaining that as a president, he is completely immune from any criminal acts, any criminal activity in which he may have engaged, including, plainly, the actions that are alleged in the indictment against him, the four-count indictment in that case. Shocking to hear members of our Supreme Court entertaining that argument seriously a couple of weeks ago, nonetheless identifying some distinction between personal behavior and official behavior, and perhaps maintaining in the end that somehow if the defendant, in this case Donald Trump, was engaged in official acts, doing things that are specifically given to him as authorities under the Constitution, that those may not be subject to prosecution, but only those things that are personal in nature. And of course, the pushback on that, among many, many other things, is that the allegations in the indictment against him partake of both. As the government lawyer Michael Dreeben said, this is an integrated conspiracy involving official acts being undertaken for personal reasons, an impossible task to parse those two things out. And for that reason, pushing back on this novel, never-before-heard concept that indeed there's a distinction between the personal and the official criminal acts of a president, that will be a major decision again coming up very soon, coming up in June of this year. probably in the next 4 to 6 weeks or so, a decision on both of those cases, the Fisher matter, the immunity case, coming out of the United States Supreme Court, depending upon what the court does, dramatically impacting what Tanya Chutkan can and cannot do as she presides over that fourth case, now also certainly not going to be tried in 2024. As always, here on our weekend broadcast, we invite callers, and specifically with comments, questions, inquiries about the subject. And we've got a caller on the line right now. Mark, you've been waiting a while. Thank you for your patience, and thank you for calling in to our broadcast this weekend.
Not a problem, Jimmy. It's fascinating to me that as somebody who dealt with evidence as an auditor, that it's either yes or no in a lot of cases. I got your point that it doesn't matter whether, you know, that Donald Trump, I guess it does matter whether, you know, that Stormy Daniels, you know, actually had sex with Donald Trump. The fact of the matter is that he tried to cover information about that encounter coming out.
That's
and
exactly
the way he
right.
did it in yep. such a way to not present it and, you know, not take it out of his personal account, but running into his business account, and that and not just, well, if he would have paid her off and, you know, got the transaction done, you know, when he promised to have it done, we might not have ever heard about this. The reason that, you know, that he's been a cheap man trying to get, you know, trying to get his way, you know, get out of paying what he should do. And the fact of the matter, you know, that what's troublesome to me is that people are complaining, well, this never happened before. We've never brought a president up on charges before. You know, this is just a conspiracy by the administration to try to, you know, knock Donald Trump out as a candidate. You know, people should have a right to vote for him as a candidate, which I claim that, well, people have the right to vote. But a candidate can disqualify himself by his actions, because no president in my memory, I don't think, has ever actually claimed that, well, I didn't actually take an oath to uphold the Constitution, you know, that even though that's what the language in the Constitution says, and make sure the laws are faithfully executed, because in this particular case, Donald Trump has never made sure that the laws are faithfully executed.
Right. And Mark, you make a very good point. Absolutely. You're invoking, again, as we've talked many times in this broadcast and others here on social and on the broadcast stations of civic media, there's this take care clause in the Constitution. That's what you're talking about, right? And one of the arguments in the immunity argument of a couple of weeks ago was just that. Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson saying, on the one hand, you've got this obligation of the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, exactly what you're saying. And at the same time, we're entertaining seriously the notion that that very person could also be engaged in criminal conduct. That's the incongruity that you're identifying. And also, to your other point about the conspiracy among all these trials, the notion that somehow there's a conspiracy afoot out there to bring all of these charges in these four different jurisdictions, that argument as well being made by people who don't understand the system. And again, relying to those people who advance that theory on the failure of Americans, some Americans, not you, not most Americans, but some Americans to engage in the critical thinking that would make impossible that kind of broad nationwide conspiracy out there. Mark, as always, thank you very much for your comment, your inquiries, and your call today. Appreciate that tremendously. As we go on with our broadcast this weekend, we're going to talk more about other cases on the docket of the Supreme Court, knowing that, again, in the weeks just ahead, many of these major decisions being issued by our highest court.
The Shaw, WAUK.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true. In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Incorporated.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Matt Nair on Air.
This is Amicus Alauraview, and my name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me on our weekend broadcast, our weekly roundup of some major stories in the area of rule of law, taking some inventory begun last weekend and continuing now, taking some inventory about these many cases to be decided by our United States Supreme Court over and above the two that we just talked about. That is the Fisher case involving the application of this federal statute to Mr. Fisher and arguably to Donald Trump as well. And also this larger immunity issue that's out there, Supreme Court indicating that it's taking seriously the possibility that a president can indeed commit crimes constitutionally and not be prosecuted for those kinds of things. All of that on the docket coming up for decision sometime in the next several weeks. Last broadcast, we talked about some of the other cases that are out there in addition to the immunity and the Fisher case as well. Talked in particular about some of the other related cases pending right now before the Supreme Court. I'm going to talk this broadcast about some of the other matters that we have similarly discussed from time to time in the past. A great number of cases involving guns and social media and agency deference. Let's talk about all of those also coming up. Social media and the First Amendment, a big focus of the Supreme Court's attention this present term, a case called Moody versus NetChoice and NetChoice versus Paxton. It was argued way back in late February or so that these two cases, they're combined, involves some similar laws that were enacted in Florida and also in Texas. And those laws impose rules, those legislative rules, on some social media companies and their content moderation policies. In particular, the practices of many social media platforms to remove things from those platforms that are overtly offensive, that are wildly wrong, those kinds of things called content moderation. And the laws that were enacted back in 2021 by Florida and Texas came in response to claims by some political folks that social media companies were silencing some of their viewpoints. At issue in these challenges then before the Supreme Court, brought by the internet associations themselves, is whether or not these state restrictions, this state legislation on the social media companies violates the First Amendment. And the justices' argument again in February, during which they seem skeptical, highly skeptical, that the Constitution does allow states to regulate private social media platforms in this way, how the companies would make decisions about the content posted on their platforms. But we'll see. We'll see what they do in this case called Moody versus NetChoice, NetChoice versus Paxton coming up. A much related case in the social media area, a case called Murphy versus Missouri. We have talked about on this broadcast as well, argued in mid-March. Another case involving a clash, if you will, between the First Amendment and the social media. Supreme Court weighed whether the Biden administration, the present presidential administration, violated an allegation of violating the free speech rights of a group of social media users when it pressured some of the social media platforms to remove some content, to do some content moderation prompted by the administration itself that was spreading misinformation, for example, about the 2020 election, spreading information to suggest that the 2020 election was not valid, that the election was stolen, and also no less significant, some wild misinformation about the COVID-19 pandemic and appropriate medical applications that could address that pandemic situation. The Biden administration reaching out to those platform providers and saying, you know, you've got information on your platforms that is inaccurate, misleading, and harmful to the American population. The dispute obviously tests how far federal officials can go in pushing platforms to take down or even maybe suppress posts before crossing some constitutional line under the First Amendment. The justices heard this case back in March. Several appeared very wary of curtailing the administration's contacts with these platforms. Some have been indicating, gee, when I was in the White House, we did this routinely. Nothing wrong with an administration reaching out to private news organizations, to platform providers, and encouraging them, not compelling them, not requiring them, not coercing them, but encouraging them to take down this misinformation about these two topics, COVID-19, the 2020 election, and other things that are contrary to the general safety and security of our nation. Social media, a big topic of the Supreme Court's focus this term. Until the immunity case was argued, you heard me routinely talk about the next case, a case called Loper-Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, also a related case called Relentless versus Department of Commerce. Talk about that case or those combined cases as being the single most significant case on the docket of the Supreme Court in, yes, this 2023-2024 term. Now, in the wake of the immunity discussion and the immunity argument, regrettably, this Loper-Bright Enterprises case, which is huge and dramatic and could have a dramatic consequence upon how we understand the role of federal agencies in America, it takes a second place on my list. What was Loper-Bright Enterprises all about? It was argued again in mid-January, a major challenge to the power of our federal agencies. The two cases, as we've talked before, call upon the Supreme Court to do something dramatic, which it's done before. It's to overrule a 1984 decision, a case called Chevron versus National Resources Defense Council. It was a case in which the court laid out a basic framework. It's known as the Chevron deference standard that requires judges to defer to an agency's interpretation of ambiguous or unclear statutes if that interpretation is reasonable. And so that's Chevron. And it has been in place by the courts and put in place by the Supreme Court, again, way back in 1984, has been a guiding principle for the courts ever since that time. The 40-year-old decision has long been a target of some of the conservative aspects of our government and others outside of government who have argued that it gives federal officials in these agencies way too much power in crafting regulations that may affect areas like environment and education, public health and employment, the workplace, all kinds of things that agencies do, Social Security Administration, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, IRS. The justices again heard arguments in January, and the court's conservative majority appeared to seem open to curtailing the agency's ability to interpret laws that are passed by the Congress in this way. If they do that, if they in fact go down this road, a major, major change in the way that our agencies, our federal agencies, are not only able to operate, but also subject to review by federal district court and appellate court judges. We know as one of the implications of that, in this case we talked about last week when we chatted about some of the abortion cases, this major case coming out of Texas involving mifepristone, there you've got a judge named Kazimierz, who decided to substitute his view, his expertise, so-called expertise as a federal judge, for the expertise of the FDA. And in not explicitly rejecting Chevron, but saying, I know better than the experts do. That's the kind of thing that could happen if indeed this Chevron deference standard is discarded by the Supreme Court, in this case called Loper-Bright Enterprises, also Relentless, coming up for decision sometime in the next several weeks. A couple of related cases in that same connection, again, a part of our general attack, if you will, upon our federal agencies, one involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau versus Community Financial Services, CFPB, also attacking the legitimacy of the way in which the CFPB was put together by Congress, maybe changing dramatically the ways in which it was put together. Supreme Court appears not inclined in that particular case to overrule the findings of the Congress that its funding source can, in fact, keep the CFPB legitimate. More on all of this as Amicus continues.
This is the Shaw, WAUK. CBS News Brief. Commencement ceremonies at some U.S. colleges are still being disrupted over those protests about the Israel-Hamas war. Columbia held small ceremonies yesterday, and this woman's sister graduated.
She was really nervous, and she was worried it was going to get canceled. I mean, we were going to come regardless, but we're glad that it didn't.
CBS News national security contributor Sam Vinograd says the protests, some of which have led to clashes and arrest, have affected more than ceremonies.
Invitations to certain speakers have been suspended. The University of Vermont and Xavier University in Louisiana suspended invitations to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
Anti-Israel protest at the Eurovision Song Contest, and a Dutch contestant is expelled over a complaint.
I imagine there is going to be postmortems and real issues with this at the highest levels of EBU in Geneva in the days and weeks to come. It won't finish at the grand final tonight.
That's Adrian Bradley covering it. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keys.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Brewers' Gasser gets the win. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Milwaukee with an 11-2 win over St. Louis Friday night. Willie Adames with three doubles, scoring two runs and a pair of RBI. Brewers lefty Robert Gasser, making his major league debut, pitched six scoreless innings, only the fifth Brewer to do so in his career debut, including Jim Slade in 1974 and Brandon Woodruff in 2017. The 24-year-old Gasser came to Milwaukee in the Josh Hader trade and was more than ready to finally get a shot at the majors. Pat Murphy:
I think Gas came with a little chip on his shoulder, like I should have been here last year in my mind. They made me wait, and maybe that's something that we can think about sometimes. Maybe we need to make some guys wait. It's great to see they get here, they pay their dues, they get here, and they got a little edge to them when they get here.
NBA former Bucks head coach Mike Budenholzer is the new head coach of the Phoenix Suns, replacing Frank Vogel, fired after just 1 year in Arizona. Coach Bud to sign a five-year deal worth $50 million. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny with a high near 65, an afternoon shower possible. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 46. For Sunday, mostly sunny, a high around 78. It will be breezy. Scattered storms Sunday night, a low of 56. More storms Monday, 67.
It's 51 at our studios.
Why choose Weikert Realtors? Because your community is our community. We're your neighbors, your students, your chefs, your soldiers, your builders, your actors, your musicians, and your radio personalities. We love this city as much as you do, and that's why we want to help you live your best life here. Because we are your realtors. Call us today and let us help you find your next home. 608-821-7002 or visit Weikert-LakePoint.com. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, a home for all.
If it's your turn to host a game, Grandpa's Barbecue suggests you try something different. Put out the perfect barbecue flavor of Grandpa's Barbecue. Add it to your ribs, dip the meatballs, or drench your wings in the original flavor of Grandpa's Barbecue. It isn't too hot or spicy, fruity or smoky or whatever. Grandpa's Barbecue. Available in select stores and online at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous, unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Crude and Dom. Dominic is in Europe on the holiday road, but you can hear some of the greatest radio shows ever in his absence. Tune in all week long.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for your continuing listening in our weekend broadcast. We're talking about the United States Supreme Court, as we often do on this broadcast, because in the weeks just ahead, we are going to be receiving from the Supreme Court decisions in about 40 different cases. Some of them are going to be dramatic, some less so. We have seen already that the Supreme Court has issued about 18 decisions in cases already decided, about 40 or so yet to go, including among them these major cases involving the prosecution of Donald Trump in the Fisher matter and the immunity matter, but also these other major cases in a number of different areas, including the extent to which our federal agencies are subject to review. And as we continue to talk about some of those cases, in addition to the Loper Bright Enterprises case, which raises directly this issue about whether or not Chevron deference by the federal courts to the experts, the people who know what they're doing inside these agencies, whether that should continue in the federal courts or should be rejected in favor of a much more independent and non-expertise-based resolution by federal judges, arguably deciding cases as they come before the judges in our federal courts. These two other cases also related to that issue of attacking, if you will, the legitimacy of our federal agencies. One of them, the Consumer Federal Financial Protection Bureau, established by the Congress through monies, through the Federal Reserve. And the argument there, the attack on the CFPB, which is put in place to ensure that rules and regulations of various banks and financial institutions are mindful of the needs and concerns and interests of consumers, of people generally who use their services, all of that subject to attack on the basis that because the CFPB gets its funding not through an appropriation of the Congress, but rather through the mechanisms of the Federal Reserve, that makes the CFPB unconstitutional, cannot stand. The appears that the Supreme Court was skeptical of that view, that the funding mechanism was inadequate or inappropriate, when they entertained argument way back on October 3rd, one of its first days in this particular term. So likely the CFPB in this particular instance will survive as the Supreme Court addresses this issue. Not so clear in connection with another case involving the Securities and Exchange Commission. Been around again for decades and decades. Securities and Exchange Commission versus Jarchese, case brought by Mr. Jarchese, who found himself in receiving end of some penalties imposed by the SEC. He maintains that the SEC improperly put together many, many decades ago by the Congress, and in particular, not given appropriate direction about what it is supposed to do, including, and Mr. Jarchese maintains, his right to a jury trial for all of the administrative decisions made by the SEC. Supreme Court seems to be a whole lot more open to that argument in the Jarchese case, SEC versus Jarchese, than they were to the CFPB case, entertaining seriously the possibility that federal agencies might have to convene juries as a part of their administrative processes before making decisions. Now, none of this, again, precludes review of agency decisions in the courts, but at the administrative level, it has been the history of all of our agencies so that they can conduct their business to do these things based, again, upon expertise and experience and tradition and the deference given to agencies to do just that. This would change dramatically the ways in which our agencies work, not only the SEC, but arguably others out there, and could again represent another attack upon and even diminution in the impact of our federal agencies as they do the work of executing the laws in America. That case, again, SEC versus Jarchese, also coming out for decision fairly soon. There are some other cases, some of which we've talked about, other cases we have not talked about on this broadcast. A major racial gerrymandering case, also on the docket of the Supreme Court, Alexander versus South Carolina Conference of the NAACP. Again, argued way back in October. We chatted a little bit about it way back in the fall. At issue in the case, the lines of South Carolina's Congressional District Number 1. A lower court struck down those lines, a particular describing of the District 1, as an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. The district was represented by Nancy Mace there was redrawn after the 2020 census to produce a safer district. And to achieve that goal, the officials in the legislature moved about 30,000 black voters from District 1 into a neighboring district. And the Supreme Court's weighing now whether race or politics was the predominant factor in making that legislative decision, making that map-making process as it was through the process of the legislature there. The justices appeared likely to leave the drawn lines intact as the legislature drew them way back after the 2020 census. Again, we'll see what the Supreme Court does. A major racial gerrymandering case coming up for decision, Alexander versus South Carolina Conference. Other cases also pending before the Supreme Court. Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy plan. This is a case called Harrington versus Purdue Pharma. Harrington versus Purdue Pharma argued in December, early December. The court fight arose from a bankruptcy plan. You may recall this in the news for Purdue Pharma, which shields the Sackler family. Remember the Sackler family? From civil lawsuits stemming from the opioid crisis. Now, the Sacklers, as you may recall, owned and they operated Purdue during the height of the opioid epidemic. And an awful lot of people with legitimate claims have maintained that because of the way that these opioids that the Sacklers produced through Purdue Pharma basically responsible for flooding our nation's streets and homes and hospitals and clinics with these opioids, causing huge amounts of addictions and the consequences of those. After Purdue filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, basically reorganization, in 2019, the family agreed basically to contribute about $6 billion as a part of the bankruptcy plan for abatement of the opioid crisis, some counseling, some other services to address the very problem that the Sacklers caused in this opioid crisis. And it was an exchange for a legal shield, a legal protection against future claims. The bankruptcy plan was approved by 90% of those victims, but several states, including some Canadian municipalities and smaller groups of some individuals, opposed it because of the protections imposed for the benefit of the Sacklers. The case involves whether those dissenters in the bankruptcy plan should be bound by the releases that were put together, the authority of the bankruptcy court, and what do we think generally about the opioid crisis and its attempt to the attempt by the bankruptcy court to try to resolve it, at least in part, by this huge amount of money, admittedly, donated, given by the Sacklers in exchange for a release on virtually all of the claims against them. The Justice Department, interestingly, has objected to Purdue's bankruptcy plan, has argued that these third-party releases are not allowed under the federal bankruptcy code. Some of the justices during the argument, again, that happened way back in December, seemed to raise some concerns about the consequences of a decision that would unravel this bankruptcy agreement, especially for victims and their families who stand to benefit from them, from those arrangements. Others noted that the plan deprives the holdouts of the ability to hold the Sacklers accountable in civil court. We will see what the Supreme Court does in addressing that major bankruptcy issue as well. A couple of other cases also out there for a resolution by the Supreme Court, an EPA case, an environmental case, Ohio versus EPA, Kinder Morgan versus EPA, America Forest versus EPA, and U.S. Steel Corp versus EPA, four cases all brought together, argued in February. In those cases, they're all brought together for argument and ultimately probably resolution. The court is considering whether to halt an environmental rule from the Biden administration that aims to curb air pollution. Air pollution is the subject of this case, and address some harmful smog that travels from certain states into others. The dispute here stems from a plan that was announced by the EPA way back in 2023, not this year, but last year, that established an emissions control program for large industrial sources like power plants and factories in about 23 states altogether. The EPA said these emissions from those facilities were contributing in a major way, very significantly, to smog pollution in downwind states. And some of those states, some of the energy companies and industry groups, challenged this initiative. Supreme Court seemed likely to halt the good neighbor rule during the arguments in February. We will see. We will see what the Supreme Court does with that case, Ohio versus EPA, Kinder Morgan, others versus EPA, an environmental case proposed again or based upon a proposal by the Biden administration to curb air pollution, but also implicating the so-called good neighbor rule that the Supreme Court is now wrestling with as it comes to terms with that major environmental case. Other cases pending before the Supreme Court. We will talk more about those in future broadcasts as well, even as we report here on this broadcast about those cases as they are decided. A lot of our attention in June going to be paid to what our Supreme Court is deciding in these major cases coming up in just a few weeks. We have another caller calling in. We appreciate very much your calls as always. John, thanks for calling in this morning. Your question, your inquiry, or your comment.
Well, first of all, how is it even reasonable that the Supreme Court look at some of these regulatory cases? Everything I have read about the establishment of these various federal agencies, going back as far as the FDA, including the EPA and other federal sure. regulatory agencies, everything I've ever read about it basically said that it was the intent of Congress that these agencies hire experts to determine what the regulations need to be. And it seems like, again, the Supreme Court is looking to overturn something that Congress actually wrote into the law. This just seems totally unreasonable. I can't imagine it being unconstitutional to do something like that. It's simply another law and or regulation, and I can't see how it violates the Constitution. It just amazes me that they'd even bother to look at some of it.
Right, right. John, I share your frustration. I hope that's come clear in my substance and perhaps even my tone as well. I think you've got it just right. And you're basically making the arguments before the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court has heard in these cases in which they say exactly that. The Congress has invested these agencies with the power to act. The Congress, members of the House, the Senate, they can't respond to every single claim that comes forward, every single issue. They necessarily have got to rely on, John, exactly what you're describing, the expertise, the people who know what they're talking about, whether medical experts, agricultural experts, commerce experts, all kinds of people out there. And the notion is that Congress has given these agencies the authority to act. This, John, is a part of a larger attack, as we have seen recently, upon our administrative, so-called the administrative state, which really doesn't exist. They're legitimate, good civil servants who are acting out there on our behalf. Do they always get it right? No, they don't. They sometimes make mistakes. And is there a remedy for that? Of course there is. You go into federal court then and challenge, as Mr. Jarchese did, a particular decision by one of these experts. But you're absolutely right. This turns on its head, not only in Loper Bright Enterprises and overturning arguably this Chevron deference, which has given the agencies the authority to act wisely on our behalf. This notion that somehow this has gotten out of control, again, probably coming in from the political arenas and affecting now the very cases before the Supreme Court. Members of the Supreme Court very seriously entertaining, rejecting the Chevron deference standard, and maybe even finding that the SEC needs to conduct jury trials, again, because of the suspicion, unfounded, unbased, about the work of the people in the SEC, those other folks out there and other agencies, if you indicated. This is what the Supreme Court's had going on in front of it. And it's the reason why, until this recent immunity case, these were at the top of my list in terms of the most significant cases the Supreme Court is deciding in this term can change dramatically, not just the SEC, not just the Loper Bright Enterprises has to do with the fisheries agency, not just that agency, not just the CFPB, but virtually any agency out there. If no longer subject to deference, that's the issue. We're going to talk more about all of that as we continue our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba. Are you and your family weather ready? I'm Terry Barr, producer of the Slice of Wisconsin series. Wisconsin weather is ever-changing, and all of us with Civic Media believe awareness can make a difference. Our weather-ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The weather impacts everything, and the history of windmills includes using the weather. In this case, the wind, to help mill grain and pump water. The modern windmills that you see across Wisconsin today are often called wind turbines. These still use the wind, but now it's to produce electricity. And a new study shows that turbines can also lower the daytime temperature while keeping it warmer at night. The moving air protects crops from frost. It's a weather-ready fact. And Saturday, May 11th, is National Windmill Day. If you really want to celebrate, save June 5th through the 9th. Because it's Windmill Days in Baldwin, Wisconsin, a celebration of Dutch heritage and the windmills in the village. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Aloraview. My name is Jim Santel, and in this, our final segment of our weekend broadcast, going to return to one of our sometimes segments called Undiscovered Justice. Not that the justice itself is undiscovered, but that the stories are sometimes undiscovered as we look at justice generally. Two matters from just this past week that are significant, stories that we've talked about before on this broadcast, two of them in particular in this, our final segment. A federal appeals court, again, in the federal system at the appellate level, just late this past week, upheld the contempt conviction of Steve Bannon. You recall him well. He's a former advisor to former President Donald Trump for having defied a subpoena from the January 6th Select Committee of the House of Representatives. Remember them? That was the organization, that was the entity inside the House of Representatives that conducted this major, very public investigation of what happened on January 6th, making referrals to the United States Department of Justice about those cases that they think should be prosecuted. The House Select Committee issuing subpoenas to many, many people, and virtually all of them at least showing up to provide information, or in some cases invoking their right under the Fifth Amendment not to testify. But in this particular case, Steve Bannon said, no, I am not going to appear. And I'm going to do so based upon the direction from Donald Trump, and also based upon a theory of executive immunity that this kind of thing cannot be pursued by a body of the House of Representatives. The decision by the court just late this past week, the appeals court, means that Steve Bannon could become the second former Trump aide to be jailed for ignoring a subpoena before the committee. You may recall that the panel previously had also submitted Peter Navarro, who once worked as a trade advisor for Donald Trump while he was the president. And after Peter Navarro also went to trial on whether or not he was in contempt of Congress for failing to show up, failing to abide by that subpoena, Peter Navarro recently went to federal prison in Miami. He's serving right now a four-month term of imprisonment in the federal court after a jury found him guilty, once again, of contempt of Congress for ignoring one of the committee's subpoenas. Well, the same thing happened. The same thing happened with Steve Bannon. He had fought his contempt conviction very forcefully in the federal trial court, which he can do. And that happened in July of 2022. The proceeding was quite a spectacle, both in court and outside. The defendant was delivering some heated speeches during the course of that trial itself, outside the courthouse, promising in the days before it began to go medieval, as he said, on the prosecutors who had brought the case against him. Well, what happened in the end is the jury returned a verdict of guilty and found him guilty of those offenses involving contempt of Congress. And so what has happened now is that in the 20-page ruling, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, we talk about them a lot, swept the arguments of Steve Bannon to a side and said, no, the judgment will stand. The jury's guilty verdict and the sentence imposed on Steve Bannon will, in fact, stay in place, a four-month term of imprisonment. And it may well be that Steve Bannon will now go to prison like Peter Navarro did. One of the arguments that Bannon raised to the appeals court was that his lawyers had advised him to ignore the committee's subpoena, and that Donald Trump himself had said, again, that he should defy the demands of the committee, and similarly that some executive status permits him to do just that. All of that rejected by the Court of Appeals. Steve Bannon, likely heading toward federal prison now, finally, after having been convicted a long time ago for contempt of Congress. That among our stories here in this segment called Undiscovered Justice. Another one in a completely unrelated setting, also important for following up on the process by which the rule of law is administered. Recall well the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband at their home in San Francisco. Just this past week, in anticipation of the sentencing of a fellow named David DePape. He was the one who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband at the time of that incident. Federal prosecutors just this past week released their pre-sentencing recommendation. They are seeking a sentence of imprisonment as to Mr. DePape, of 40 years imprisonment, again, for having attacking Paul Pelosi, the husband of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The petition, the memorandum submitted by the government in this case says this: the violent lessons that the defendant wanted to teach are not permitted in this country, and the sentence that this court imposes must reflect the nature and circumstances of the offense. That's what the government wrote in anticipation of the sentencing coming up in just a little over a week or so. Government attorneys said they wanted the defendant, David DePape, to serve a longer sentence than the one recommended by the U.S. Probation Office, which was recommending 25 years in prison, followed by 5 years of supervised release. It's a 20-page court filing. They said that they agree with, in a significant part, with what the Probation Office is saying, that some guidelines, and the sentencing guidelines, that terrorism enhancement should apply, and that would lengthen the sentence somewhat. But beyond that, they said the defendant intended to promote a federal crime of terrorism when he attacked Nancy Pelosi's home and specifically attacked Paul Pelosi on that night. Intending to commit this terrorist act, defendant DePape was found guilty in November of attempted kidnapping of a federal official. Of course, that is Nancy Pelosi herself. An assault on an immediate family member, the federal law also prohibits that, of an elected official. Prosecutors emphasized that this 40-year sentence, again, was based upon their assessment of what happened during the course of the trial, and more specifically, the facts that prompted the prosecution in the first place. You remember this matter quite dramatically, the break-in of the household there in San Francisco, Paul Pelosi responding, and going on to say in this case presented by the government, at a time when extremism has led to attacks on public and elected officials, this case presents a moment to speak to others harboring ideologically motivated violent dreams and plans. The case presents strong deterrent value to say that violent ideological attacks will be punished to the full extent of the law. Again, taking up what we have often talked about on this broadcast, which is the importance of deterrence, specific deterrence against people like David DePape, somebody who would engage in this kind of not only violent behavior, but also terrorist behavior based upon the sentencing guidelines and the way that this case will be resolved, but also sending this larger general deterrence message out there that those who might engage in similar conduct in the future may find themselves in a similar circumstance. Again, the break-in of the Pelosi home going to be the subject now of the sentencing of David DePape coming up on May 17th. We'll report on that as well as we continue to do that and report on the trial, not only in Manhattan, but other cases around our nation here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
Earl Ingram.
Monday morning, join me as I stroll through memory lane and take in the sounds of the Motor City. It's Motown Mondays.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
Big deals. the WAUK Big Deal Store is open and has 30% savings at some of the area's best restaurants. The Delafield Brew House, Taylor's People's Park, and Max Macaroni and Cheese. You simply go to WAUKradio.com, click on the Big Deals tab, and save. You'll also find 30% off at Sal's Pizza, Juanita's Sushi and Seafood, and Club 400. Again, go to WAUKradio.com, click on Big Deals, choose Waukesha, and save on your next great meal with Big Deals from WAUK.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming.